97.9 The Hill, WCHL, and UNC School of Media and Journalism present Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus, dedicated to in-depth examination of issues of overriding importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the Carolina campus, here's your host, UNC Journalism Professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, mega buyouts for coaches and the NC2A case against BYU point guard Nick Emery. Our guest, Jay Billis, noted sports commentator and critic of the NC2A, the man Reese Davis calls the most capable guy in sports journalism when it comes to legal and NC2A matters. So, Jay, here we are at the University of North Carolina with a new football coach and paying the previous football coach $3 million a year not to coach. What's wrong with that picture?
Nothing really. It's just business. I'm not sure that it would differ in the way you would look at it if you fired a university president. The university president had a similar buyout. It's just the way business works. And if the University of North Carolina or any other school didn't want to pay such a buyout, then they shouldn't have signed it in the first place. It's really not that hard of an analysis. But the problem comes when we're discussing things in the context of college sports and sort of the rhetoric of the NCAA, which is kind of, you know, this is all amateur and it's just for fun and all that other stuff. And this is really about education. That's what gets them in the bind. And when you compare it against the other things that the organization does. But other than that, it's just kind of business as usual in America, and really not that big of a deal.
So it basically is the cost of doing business, but the people responsible for generating the money for that business don't get very much of a cut of the pie.
Well, that's the rub, and that's what makes it sort of inequitable. We don't have that kind of restriction with regard to any other students. So the idea is just about, you know, these are students, and which the NCAA says all the time, hey, these are students, as if that statement is dispositive of the issue. No other student is told they can't make money while they're in school, whether on scholarship or not, or they can't accept anything of monetary value because of their reputation in a given field. And look, it's clear that no other student is used to make money like athletes are. So that makes it doubly, triply, you know, quadruply, however many you want to tag onto it, sort of hypocritical or contradictory. But that's sort of, you put your finger on really the issue with regard to buyouts and then the idea of amateurism. A large buyout in a multi-billion dollar business isn't surprising, and it shouldn't be infuriating to anyone. Any more than a severance package would be for a CEO that has a golden parachute. Those things are negotiated at arm's length on the front end of things, and everybody, you know, they're all adults. It's not a big deal. It's just within the context of the structure and the rhetoric of the NCAA that we're going, wait a minute, that, you know, this stuff doesn't go together, and it doesn't fit within the framework that the NCAA likes to say. They have to do a lot of tap dancing to justify it.
I think, Jay, even if it were the CEO, I think the worker bees do kind of find that sort of thing infuriating. You know, let's again look at this particular situation, $3 million a year, more or less, to the new guy, plus $3 million a year to the old guy. So there you are at $6 million. Some schlub teaching, you know, history, maybe after a certain number of years is making $100K. You'd have to work for 30 years to get to $3 million.
Yeah, I hear that, but that's the free market. And nobody, you know, nobody's holding a gun to anybody's head in this. The issue and where this differs is, the as you're saying, the professor that's making $100,000 or whatever position you used as an example, they have the opportunity, that professor has the opportunity to say no, they have the opportunity to negotiate more, they have the opportunity to bring other offers in, say, hey, I've got this offer at another school, I'm going to take this unless you pay me more. The athlete doesn't have that opportunity. If you want to be, you know, in that industry, you are going to be restricted. And no other person has those restrictions on them. And it's a cartel restriction across the board. So while I hear you that people may not like it, and they may be infuriated by it. You know, that it's business. It's just part of the business. And you know, we can make the same sort of general lament with regard to anything, like saying, hey, teachers should make more, or firefighters should make more. You know, it's criminal how this works. But that's the free market more than anything. I don't think any reasonable person is saying that the contributions of teachers in our society are underpaid. Of course they're underpaid and undervalued financially. But we're not remedying that. The free market is not remedying that. That's a free market issue. You know, the fact that a singer that makes way more money than a firefighter can be infuriating, but that's a free market thing. And nobody is saying, well, the firefighters can only make this, and we are all agreeing that across the board with the cartel rule. That's not happening. That's just the free market doing it.
So let's go back to your previous point, is these players are like the firefighters who are making money for the fire department, but not making any money for themselves, other than the, quote, cost of attendance.
They're not like the firefighters in any way, shape, or form. The firefighters can negotiate at arm's length and make as much as they can negotiate. That's not true of athletes. They can't. All they get are their expenses. And so it's not like anything else. It is its own, it's sort of in its own category in this country. No other person, especially in a multi-billion dollar business, is restricted as to what they can earn across the board. Nobody. There is not one. And certainly there's no other student. There's nobody. And there's no analog to this. So to say that, hey, you know, there are other industries where people don't make a lot of money. I get that. There, but that's a free market force. It's not analogous to the athlete. And I hear the comparison you're trying to make the point. But you know, the athletes are unique in this regard, absolutely unique. And I hear people say it all the time. They say, well, I wish somebody would give me that deal. Well, you had the opportunity to get that deal and more. In fact, as a non-athlete, you have the opportunity to get a far better deal than an athlete does. You as a non-athlete can get whatever your talents will command in the marketplace. The athletes cannot get that. And that's, I happen to think that's wrong to the point of immoral when they're being sold for billions of dollars in the free market, and yet they can't participate in it.
Sports Focus will be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with Jay Billis. The first segment was about mega buyouts for coaches. And Jay, now I want to talk about sanctions that are handed out by the NCAA. And I've, you know, covered sports for a long, long time, and I've seen many head-scratching decisions by this body. And I want to talk specifically about BYU guard point guard Nick Emery. So BYU is going to have to vacate a bunch of games, and it's because supposedly or reportedly Emery took $12,000 worth of money or goods. And the big thing seems to be that one of these boosters had ready access to the locker room. What more can you tell us about the Nick Emery case?
Not much more. I read all the same things and talked to all the same people you did. It's basically the odd part about it is the sanction that people get most up in arms over is the idea of the vacating of games and sort of the erasure of those games from the record book, because it affects the coach and it affects the school. And for some reason, fans and others get really worked up over it, which is exactly what the NCAA likes to see, because they think that that punishment hurts and therefore is a deterrent to future wrongdoing, and it changes, you know, behaviors. I happen to disagree with that. I don't think it's a deterrent at all. I don't think it changes any behaviors that any other sort of sanction wouldn't do just as well. And it's an odd sanction because everybody it winds up sort of pointing out the wins rather than taking them away, if you will. The funny part about this whole thing is the NCAA vacates a win, but they don't vacate the loss. So all these schools that have wins vacated, all they have to do is say count losses. Just say, you know, BYU losses and opponent losses, and the record's exactly the same, and it's NCAA compliant. You know, it's and that way everybody can just kind of move on. It's a really dumb sanction, but that's what everybody's mad at. They're not mad at the fact that there was probation or the kid had to sit out a certain amount of time. He had to sit out 9 games or something and pay the money back and all that stuff. You know, the NCAA's rules and their enforcement is really odd. I'm not saying they shouldn't have rules and shouldn't enforce those rules. They should. But it should make sense, and these things don't make sense.
So that leads me to the what I'll call the Adidas case. What, you know, if anything would be a deterrent, or if anything in the past was going to be a deterrent, you think it would put the kibosh on things like under the table payments to kids and parents, you know, in playing in, you know, AAU ball and et cetera, but I don't see anything that the NC2A has ever done that would be called a deterrent.
No, but that's an argument that I agree with that. I don't think that their rules do deter the behavior they're trying to curb, but that can be stated about you know, our law enforcement in this country and really in countries around the world. It is difficult to fashion rules and punishments that are going to deter future bad behavior on the part of others. For the most part, people do what they're asked to do, and they avoid doing what they're prohibited from doing because they have a strict moral code. Most people do. You're still going to have wrongdoing out there. That you're going to have nothing that stops that. So the issue really is, you know, are these punishments reasonable and effective? And I think the answer with regard to most NCAA punishments, the answer is no. You know, you see it in our society with mandatory minimums. Well, you could argue that, well, that's going to deter people. Well, it doesn't. And all it does is ruin people's lives. And it has a negative effect on our society rather than a deterrent effect and a positive one. And I would argue that the same, you know, a similar type of thing happens with NCAA rules and enforcement at times. I don't think that the punishment oftentimes fits the infraction, but the NCAA likes to say, and a lot of people like to say, well, you know, if we want this to stop, we got to throw the book at them. We got to get rid of all these coaches. You know, they're gonna just ban people, and it doesn't work. You know, they've been banned. SMU got the death penalty in 1986. Didn't work. All it did was ruin SMU's program for decades, and it didn't stop any other bad behavior. Same thing with Penn State. You know, do people really believe that a full ban is going to stop, you know, horrifying actions on the part of Jerry Sandusky, and they think it's going to be more effective of a deterrent than jail? You know, I find that kind of laughable in what is a horrifying case.
Sports Focus will return right after this.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle, and now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with Jay Billis about a lot of things involving college athletics, and most recently we're talking about sanctions that the NC2A meets out and whether those are useful in any way. So, Jay, if they're not, what is the alternative?
The alternative is to have more reasonable rules and to enforce them in a more reasonable fashion. I think I mentioned before, I'm certainly not a person that's opposed to rules. We live in a rules-based society. You know, I follow all the rules I'm required to follow. I violate the speed limit from time to time, but for the most part, I follow the rules. But I think there's a difference between, you know, having unreasonable rules that are enforced in an unreasonable fashion and reasonable rules that are enforced reasonably. I think people respond to reasonable in a pretty good way. So while I think the difficulty that people have is that there's, you know, when you're on the outside and it's a case you're not involved in, it's easy to be all law and order and say, throw the book at them. You know, they didn't get enough. Just even with the North Carolina academic case, I think that a lot of people outside that didn't know the ins and outs of the case are are very upset about the NCAA's result in that case. But they don't understand the rules. They don't even understand what North Carolina was charged with. And usually that kind of thing, that lack of understanding by the public and people who aren't involved in the case, works in the NCAA's favor. In this case, it didn't. It worked against the NCAA, and it certainly worked against the University of North Carolina from a perception standpoint. But I just don't see how it's so difficult to have reasonable rules. I think it's actually pretty easy.
So let's go to Louisville and the situation of paying prostitutes, and then on top of that, the Shoegate issue. Is the right thing to get rid of the coach?
Well, that's a university matter. The NCAA doesn't get rid of the coach. They can. What the NCAA can do is sanction the coach by suspending the coach or putting a show cause order on the coach where it would be difficult to get hired. But firing the coach is like your point about the buyout. That's a school issue. That's not an NCAA issue. So with regard to Louisville, it was Louisville's decision to fire Rick Pitino. It was not the NCAA. So I don't think that's anything we really have to worry about. All these coaches and administrators serve at the pleasure of their institution. So the NCAA wants these rules in place, and most of these rules are in place to keep the athletes in line. And for no other reason, it's to keep the athletes amateur so that the NCAA institutions can control all the money. That's all it is. I can't imagine. They don't have these same rules for athlete health. They just have for athlete money. They're not sanctioning schools for neglecting athlete health or for not doing the right thing in that regard. They're doing it for athlete money. And, when people say it's not about money, they're right. It's not about money. It's about how much and who gets it. And in every case, the school gets it.
So the schools are, the NC2A is made up of the schools. So, I see often schools trying to absolve themselves of a lot of the responsibility because as they put it on the NC2A, well, there would be no NC2A if it weren't for the schools.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I think that's kind of a straw man argument, honestly. That's like saying, well, the United States government is made up of the people, so we have no right to complain about laws we don't like. We should just change them. And where would we be if we didn't, if we weren't the United States? We should be grateful to be here. I hear that, but that's not, I don't think that justifies bad rules. And when just going back to the University of North Carolina case, when the University of North Carolina was caught up in that and was being mistreated by the NCAA, I don't think it was a very, very satisfying argument to say, well, the University of North Carolina is part of the NCAA, therefore, that's too bad. You make the argument, you prosecute the case and defend the case and deal with it to what suits your best interests. And when I say NCAA, though, in this discussion, I'm referring to the schools. I'm referring to the office in Indianapolis and the schools. So I use the NCAA's own rhetoric when they say the NCAA is the schools. Well, then I'm saying when the schools are making money, that's the NCAA making money. It's not just, so the NCAA office makes money off of their revenue comes from the NCAA basketball tournament. But there are billions of dollars of NCAA money that's being generated through the conferences and the schools themselves. And that's NCAA money too.
So Jay, in the final 30 seconds that we have left, do we even need the NC2A anymore? I mean, the Power Five conferences are pretty much calling their own shots, at least in football.
No, we don't. But to this point, it hasn't been financially feasible or the right thing to form something else. And the Power Five schools have their own autonomy on so many different issues, but I don't think we'll see the same structure lasting forever. There's too much money at stake, so you'll see the bigger schools getting more and more of a say as we go forward. And at some point, you'll see the athletes being able to share in it. Whether it starts out with name and likeness rights, once name and likeness rights are provided to the athletes, pay is not far behind it because the schools will want to control the deals that players can cut, and that means they'll don't want to pay them so they can have more control in that regard.
And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Jay Billis. Thanks also to engineer Gary Kirk, and as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall at the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a service of UNC School of Media and Journalism.